Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Welcome to episode 44 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month, we have a great interview with the marvellous Cheyenne Blue, Australian author extraordinaire. And you're going to hear the interview we did a few weeks ago very shortly. But first, let's see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as finding out what's going on in the world of lesfic and in the world of me. First up, as usual, the Amazon charts, and topping the chart in the UK as I record this on April 17th, 2018, happy birthday to my friend Claire McCall, is Monica McCallan's Back to the Start. Now, Monica is a new author on the block to me. It's her second book, apparently, according to her Amazon author page. And this one is about Remy, who's forced to leave San Francisco when her grandma dies and go back to her small town roots. And who should be waiting for her when she gets back to said small town? Yes, none other than her first love, Fallon. Remy and Fallon, full marks for an image there to Monica McCallan. So cue much soul-searching, heartbreaking, re-emerging first love feelings. Who doesn't love a second chance small town romance? It's selling like hotcakes. It's number one in the US, so you can go and see what all the fuss is about. Also doing well in the US and UK is Harper Bliss with her latest collaboration, A Swing at Love. And this one, her second collaboration after the one she did with me, hooray, is with her wife Caroline. And I'm really thrilled for them both that it's doing so well because I know it's nervy. It's nervy putting a book out there, and this is Caroline's debut, so well done. It's a break from Harper's traditional steamy style. This one is the story of Diane Thompson, a divorced accountant, and Tamsin Foxley, a golf tutor. And when the pair meet at a local golf club, one straight, the other someone who normally prefers women half her age, they become friends, and then could they become something more? Well, they can if they can both accept that this might be their fate. But can they? Full marks for Tamsin Foxley. What a great character name. She sounds very onomatopoeic to me, like she might be a little bit sort of, I wouldn't say predatory, that sounds bad, but it sounds like she's slinky. She's slinky and sleek, old Tamsin Foxley. And it looks like the pair, Harper and Caroline, have scored a hole-in-one with their first joint effort. So give that a go if you like a sweet romance that fades to black. Also doing well is Georgia Beer's The Shape of You, as well as riffing on Ed Sheeran's Words. It's also causing waves in the charts in the US and the UK. This one is a little different to the normal formula of girl meets girl, girl loses girl, girl gets girl, hooray! Because in this one, one of the women starts out engaged and then does some cheating. I know, gasp. Now, lesbian readers don't like cheating. I have had that rammed home to me a few times. They prefer to live in a bubble where cheating doesn't exist. Now, I totally get that because, you know, fiction is a happy, happy land. But also, I like my fiction to be somewhat based in reality, and I want to experience all the emotions. And as long as the book has a happy ending, I generally like a happy ending, then I don't mind if there's some friction on the way. In fact, it makes it a better journey. So I think this book sounds interesting. I haven't read it yet, but Georgia is normally a good bet. So see what you think of the story of Rebecca and Spencer and the will they, won't they dilemma. Hot tip, it's a lesbian romance, so I think they will. A.E. Radley's Climbing the Ladder is also flying high in the charts. This is the story of Chloe Dixon and her first week on a job where she inadvertently causes a PR disaster. Disaster! Can she recover? If you are a Radley fan and she is pumping out those books left, right and centre, then this one is probably for you. Meanwhile, Cara Malone's Love Trauma is a lesbian medical romance with some sultry eyes staring out at you from the cover, drawing you into the story. It's the story of Chris Evans? No, that's a carrot-topped radio DJ in the UK, not Chris Evans. Chris Stevens, and she is the best trauma doctor in the area, Natch, and she meets Darcy, a retired medical doctor who's licking her wounds and rebuilding her life. When the two met, after Darcy accidentally poisons somebody she knows and has to bring her to the trauma department, Darcy knows that she wants Chris in her life. But will Chris be on board? Read the book and find out. And one last new book to mention, well, newish, and that's Ariana by Emma Nichols, which is still top five in the UK. Now, Emma's debut novel burst onto the summer scene last year, and this year's offering has done equally well. The story of Ariana, who hotfoots it back to clear the estate of her late grandma. There are an awful lot of dead grandmas in Lesvic, aren't there? And while she's there, Ariana meets local taverna owner Nikki. Cue slow smiles, heart eyes, too much ouzo, and boom, love on a Greek island. It's like Shirley Valentine all over again, but without the bloke with the dodgy tash or something. Emma excels at writing books, sun-splashed romances, I'd say. So if you like that sort of thing, I suggest downloading it or borrowing it on Kindle Unlimited. So that is the chart roundup for August 2018, and I don't know about you, but the year seems to have gone on fast forward of late. One minute it was May, and now it's nearly September. How did that happen? Panic alert! Although I do like September because it is my birthday month. Yay for all the Virgos in the crowd. High five. So what have I been up to since we last spoke, dear listener? Well, I've got back from my three-week holiday at the beginning of July, and then I've been busy writing book five in the London romance series called London Actually. I had a deadline of finishing the first draft before I went on holiday again. I know, on holiday again, just a week this time though, on August the 1st, and I managed it. Yippee! And now I'm just going through that first draft and reworking the story. But I'm pretty pleased with the first draft, I have to say. You never quite know. Like, what I do is I write every day until it's done, and I normally get the first draft of the story down in a month, and then I leave it for a week or two, and then I come back, and you do forget what you've written, so you never quite know if you've gone off at a tangent or, you know, something. And sometimes, you know, this week I've had a couple of moments where I've punched myself on the arm and gone, hey, good line. So that's nice. I also had a couple of days this week where I put my head in my hands and went, what? But it's all par for the course. My stories normally go through at least four drafts before I launch. So it's still early days with this one, as I'm just going through and doing draft two. But the book is due to go to the editor in September. So that'll be good to see what she thinks of it as well. And once the first draft was done, though, my wife and I went away with some good friends for a week in a villa in Croatia, which was great. I haven't swum so much in years, and the days were spent by the pool reading, which was ace, and the nights spent eating steaks the size of my head, along with large gin and tonics. So what's not to love there? I did get some reading done while I was away, which was great. I read Rachel Elliott's Whispers Through a Megaphone, which is a terrific, warm, funny and quirky novel. It's not a lesbian romance, but it is modern fiction with LGBT characters, and I really enjoyed that one, so I'd recommend that. I also read a steampunk novel by Lise McTeague, who's coming on the podcast next month to talk about it, and it's not my normal genre by any stretch of the imagination, but I actually did enjoy it and learned some things about world building in it, so that was good too. And while I was away, I also read through a non-fiction book I wrote 10 years ago about how to be a lesbian. And because I'm going to release it, I'm going to polish it up and release it later this year. And so obviously I was trepidatious because, you know, 10 years is a long time in life, never mind a long time in writing. I mean, I'd like to think that I've become a much better writer since 10 years ago. Obviously, I was a journalist for 15 years prior to becoming a lesbian romance novelist, so I knew I could write non-fiction, and that's what I did for my first book 10 years ago. So the upshot was the book wasn't too bad. It a lot of it is usable. A lot of it needs reworking to update it, but it even had some jokes in it that made me snort, which either means the jokes have stood the test of time or I've still got very bad taste in jokes, but I'll let you know. So once I've done with London, actually, I'm going to concentrate on bringing that book up to scratch and getting it out there. In audiobook news, my collaboration with Harper Bliss, Once Upon a Princess, is being produced in audio. Hooray! And it will be out in October, so look out for that, and I will let you know when that's out. Very exciting. Finally, if you're in the UK or Europe, don't forget that the European Lesfic Literary Convention, or ELCON to its mates, takes place in Bristol next week, August 23rd and 24th. There's going to be panels, discussions, readings and workshops. And at the end of the day, we're all going to go out for dinner and drink more wine than we should. So if lesfic is your bag and you want to meet writers and readers of the craft, then head on over to elconmeet.org on the tinternet for tickets and more details. I would love to see you there. And if you are coming, do come and say hi. Now let's get on with the interview with the wonderful Cheyenne Blue. So joining me today is Cheyenne Blue, who is an Australian author whose latest book is Code of Conduct, and I just finished reading it and it is brilliant. So Cheyenne also has written another series, the Girl Meets Girl series, and also had another book out, Party Wall. Cheyenne lives in the north end of the Sunshine Coast, a couple of hours from Brisbane or Brisvegas to its friends, and is a huge tennis fan, unsurprisingly. So welcome today, Cheyenne.
Hi, thanks Claire. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great. Great to have you here. And it's 9 a.m. in the morning here in London, and it is 6 p.m. in Brisbane, as we know, near Brisbane, not that close to Brisbane. Cheyenne sitting there with a glass of wine. I've got a cup of tea. So far we're conforming to Aussie and English stereotypes, aren't we?
Yeah, we are, but I think I've got the best of it with my wine, I have to say. I'm not a tea drinker, so.
So even at 9 a.m., you'd be sitting there with a glass of wine?
Oh, no, no.
What's your tipple in the morning, then, if you're not a tea drinker?
Long black, half strength, shot of milk on the side.
Right, okay.
My friends all, like, roll their eyes in horror and they go, can't you drink real coffee, you know, like real, you know, puts hair on your chest type of coffee, but no.
What's the difference with what you had then? Just like it's a bit weak, is it?
Just a bit weaker. I'm not a fan of the really strong, bitter stuff you get, can get in a lot of cafes. So I just have it half strength and I'm quite happy. I just drink twice as much.
There you go. Yeah, each to their own. You see, I am the opposite. I like nuclear strength coffee. So, yeah, I've just come back from a holiday in America and they do nuclear strength coffee there. So I was very pleased. It's difficult to get it in the UK. But anyway, enough about me and my coffee habit and your coffee habit. Let's talk about writing, because that's what we're here to talk about. So tell listeners a bit about your journey and how you got started.
Well, it goes back quite a long way, actually. Although I'm sort of relatively new in the lesbian romance stakes, I've actually been writing since 1999. When I read an erotica short story on a website, which I think is now gone, it was called Clean Sheets, and it was absolutely fantastic. And it was short literary erotica, and it went all across, you know, the various genres and sexualities. And I was reading this quite regularly and really enjoying it, I have to say. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I can do that. So I wrote a short story and sent it off, and lo and behold, they liked it. So I wrote another one. And I kept going at that for quite some number of years, just writing short erotica. Mm. And then in 2014, I had to commute down to Brisvegas for work, and I was spending 2 hours each way on a commuter train. And during that time, I just thought, well, I wonder if I can write something longer. So I gave it a go, and that was my first novella, Never Tied Nora. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I've stuck with romance since, and I think I'll stick with it a while longer.
Right, okay. I do though bow down at the feet of erotica writers, because I do think it's a really hard sort of genre to master. And I mean, do you still dabble a little bit, or are you completely doing romance now?
No, not really, to be honest. I have written a couple of shorter pieces for, you know, a couple of anthologies more recently, and I've made them fade to black. So while I'm quite happy to include erotic scenes in the novels, and I'd like to read them too, so that's why I write them, I've sort of gone away a bit from the short erotica into more romance, which is more happy, happy, clappy, clappy, and I love it.
Yeah, who doesn't love a bit of happy, clappy? So that's interesting. But obviously, a lot of your erotica is still out there sale, should people want to go and have a look at it. So obviously now you're concentrating far more on the romance. So how would you describe your books to someone who's never read one?
Oh, happy, big. I was actually thinking of, you know, taglines for my website and the likes, and I came up with big-hearted romance, which I think fits pretty well. My characters, they obviously all have happy endings, and my characters are, they're fairly low-angst stories, and the characters are generally cheerful types because I don't think I'm a cheerful type, so maybe it's writing what I know.
Big-hearted anyway, romance with cheerful types. That's I like that. I'd read that. I think it goes along.
I tend to write a lot of supporting characters, and I like them to have a story too. So it's not just a main character couple sort of in their own little bubble. They tend to have lives and families and friends and a situation that they're in. So it's sort of more encompassing than just sort of focusing on the internal angst of the main characters, which I love those books, but I just don't seem to be able to write them very well.
Yeah. I'd also say that there's a fair splash of humour in your books as well. So from reading Code of Conduct, anyway, that's why I picked up.
Yeah, I call it incidental humour. They're not straight out romantic comedies or anything like it, but there's just a little bit of sort of Aussie humour, you know, the wry, dry sort.
Yeah, I'm well aware of it. I know a few Aussies in my life, so yeah, well aware of that. So let's talk about your most recent book, Code of Conduct, which, as I said, I read for this interview, and I really, really loved it. I haven't read many lesbian sports books, and I will say that it is a romance at its heart, but it's based around the world of tennis, and I'm not a huge tennis fan, but I really loved reading about the world of tennis, and it was really clear to me that you had a very deep understanding of tennis, but also, as I said, it's got conflict, it's got the ultimate sacrifice for love, which always warms my heart. So tell me a little bit about writing this one, and as I said, you obviously have a love for tennis, and tell us do you play it as well?
I do play it. You're actually talking to the under 10 runner-up girls lawn tennis champion for Reigate Lawn Tennis Club in 1970 something.
Well, I did not know.
And that is pinnacle of my career.
I did not know that. I mean, you've got so many strings to your bow.
Under 10, did you get that far?
I did. I didn't focus on that bit. You know, you won a tennis cup. That's brilliant.
Yeah, but no, I grew up in England, and my mum used to, when Wimbledon was on, that was it. Nothing else happened in the house for a fortnight. Nothing. We'd come home from school and you'd let yourself in the door and there'd be no food in the house and there'd be no milk and there'd be nothing happening and the house would be a mess and she'd be just sitting in front of the telly, hunched over with her cup of tea and a rich tea biscuit, and the tennis would be on. So, you know, you sort of, I learned pretty early on to sort of sit down and watch it with her. And also figured out that if we were watching tennis, we could stay up as late as we want and we could do basically whatever we want and we could eat whatever we want. So there was a bit of sort of side motivation to it. But from those earliest days when I was honestly, I don't know, 7, 8 or so, I've always watched tennis and I've always loved it. It's the only sport I do watch, to be honest.
Right, okay. Right.
And so when I was trying to think about my next novel, I knew that I wanted to write a tennis novel because it's always been there, and I still follow it now. We go to the tournament here in Brisbane most years, and I've been to Wimbledon and the Aussie Open. So it's something I knew, and I thought I had the background knowledge to make it a convincing novel, which I think is important for things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, from the opening pages of the novel, you are inside Viva's head and you're on the court with her, which I thought was very cleverly done. So you definitely got that. So did you read up a bit on player psychology, or did you just fall back on what you knew anyway?
No, to be honest, I just winged that. I sort of I think I know it pretty well. I follow a lot of tennis forums and, you know, tennis blogs and the like. So mm-hmm. I have an interest in the sport outside of just simply watching the boing boing of the match.
Yeah.
That part I didn't have to read up on. There are things I did, like the umpires. The other character, the two characters, Viva, she's a professional tennis player. But the second character, Gabriella, she's a tennis umpire. And I had to do a bit of research for that because umpires are very genuinely, in real life, not allowed to form any sort of relationship with a tennis player, and that includes even friendship. So I did a bit of research around the umpire's code of conduct, which is obviously where the title comes from, had to, you know, check up on that and check I had the facts correct. Also a bit on the tennis bodies and the like. But player psychology, no, that was already there in my head, I think.
Yeah, that's your under-10s win, you see. That was it was all coming through.
But no, my under-10s win was a fluke because I've got one shot and it's a hard, flat one. I can't do any other tennis shot.
I wouldn't do yourself down, you know. You need to hang your hat on the under-10s win. I really like the, as you were saying there, the other main character is Gabriella, who's an umpire. I would assume that most tennis books that have gone before have been between romances between players, but your romance is between the player and the umpire. So how did you come up for that? Because I think that's a bit of a unique storyline.
Oh, well, thank you. To be honest, there's an umpire who has inspired this and I'm going to say her name because it's not actually her, fairly obviously. Her name is Eva Azdaraki-Moore and she's the umpire, she's a gold badge umpire, which is what Gabriella aspires to in the story. And I was watching a replay of a US Open final between Serena Williams and Sam Stosur from maybe 2010, 2011, and Sammy won. But at some point during the match, Serena had this meltdown and started screaming at the umpire and, you know, chucking her racket about. And the umpire was super cool and so calm and so gorgeous, I have to say. And I fell in love with her a little bit during that match. And I've actually sort of kept an eye out for her ever since because she's just great to watch. And if you watch the umpires and their interactions with the players, it sort of adds to the overall tennis experience. Mm. So when I knew I wanted to write an umpire, I had her in my head as the prototype of a cool, calm and collected umpire.
Right.
And I see how she could, you know, bounce off and clash with a rather fiery tennis player like Serena Williams did with this same umpire, you know, all those years ago.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, no, that's really interesting because I guess being an occasional tennis fan, you know, like a Wimbledon tennis fan, really, I just tend to watch the players, not the umpires. But yeah, adds a little bit to it. I have actually been. I went to Wimbledon. I've only been once, living in London. Sorry?
Did you do the queue, the Wimbledon queue?
I did do the Wimbledon queue, yeah, yeah. And got in eventually. And I was just amazed at how, like, you actually do that cartoon thing of your head goes, like, just left, right, left, right. It was, it was like watching a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, watching everybody watch. I was more sort of intrigued by watching the crowd. So, but it was good. And we had a beer and some strawberries. So, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. I've always met great people at Wimbledon. I remember one year we went and we were sitting right at the very top of court two, I think it was, watching Amélie Mauresmo, who's another of my tennis crushes. All my crushes are lesbian tennis players or whatever, they are tennis players. Mm-hmm. There was a row of old ladies from some sort of suburban UK tennis club and they're all sitting in the long line at the back with their gin and tonics and it probably was 10 o'clock in the morning. And every time one of the players did a great shot, they'd be like, oh, jolly good, great shot, and then there'd be this rapturous applause and they'd have another swig of their gin and tonic. It was absolutely great.
Yeah, that sounds very much like it. So And when I watched the recent Wimbledon, which is very, very recent, wasn't it? Like ended a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. My mind was full of Viva and Gabriella because I think I just finished reading your book, and I think that's when you know you've got a great book on your hands, because it's like when it bleeds into real life. Another thing I really loved is that Viva was commentating with quite a sexist. I don't know if it was a former player that you had in the book. And also one of the secondary characters in the book, Helena, comes out during the season. And I love that you got those details in. So how important was it for you to highlight real issues like sexism and homophobia in sport? Because I don't know if you know about, I can't remember the name of the guy, John somebody, who's a commentator at Wimbledon a few years ago, and made that really inappropriate comment about, now I can't remember the name of the woman that won. Who was the Italian woman that won Wimbledon one year?
Oh, Francesca, no, she didn't win. Italian.
I think she's Italian or Spanish. She's now a commentator on the BBC.
Muguruza?
Sorry?
Gabinia Muguruza.
Her.
She's Spanish. One, yes. I think last year, though.
Yes. Yes, it was her, because she's now a commentator on the BBC. And one of the commentators, when she won, because she's lost a lot of weight since she won, and, like, you know, she was hardly big because she's winning Wimbledon. but the commentator made a terrible comment, like, basically kind of said, I bet she didn't get many men in her youth, or she's kind of like the type of woman that only a mother could love. And I just thought, oh my God. And he's still commentating on Wimbledon, and it's just crazy. These are real life events. So how important was it for you to get this sort of thing into the books?
Well, you've absolutely nailed it when you mentioned that commentator. And actually, thinking back, I think it might have been Marion Bartoli, who's a French player.
Oh, maybe it was her.
I think I remember that and being absolutely – it was obnoxious, wasn't it, that commentator?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of older – and I'm going to generalise crazily here. There's a lot of older men, like middle-aged and older, commentating on the women's game. And unfortunately, you get a lot of sexist crap like that, commentating about their skirts or their dresses as if this is important. And, you know, you would get a few inappropriate comments too about, you know, them hitting like a man or something like that, which doesn't belong. And even now, and I have to say, some of the old Aussie dinosaurs are some of the worst, you can get just some, you know, crap from the commentators that really puts down a woman's sporting achievement and focuses his back on to how pretty she is in a dress or whatever, or mm-hmm. the modelling contract she's got or whatever it is. So I didn't actually set out to highlight it, but once I was into the story, I knew I just wanted to have a little dig at some of those very inappropriate commentators. And Viva was my mouthpiece, and she put them down rather nicely, I think.
She did. And also you had the other character, Helena, coming out during the book. I love the way you did that as well. And I think probably that's happened in real life as well, hasn't it?
Tennis has a lot of out players in it. You know, all the way back to Billie Jean King and Martina Navratilova, who were the first two professional women's sports people to come out. And I think that might have been the 80s or the 90s. I really can't remember. But I'm sure there's probably closeted players too, because there's players from countries that aren't as accepting of LGBT rights. So they probably have to stay closeted for reasons of their own. But I think as time goes on, there's more and more obviously coming out. And with the Yelena character, it was to try and show that, the you know, it's not just easy as coming out and saying it. There's often other reasons, which I don't, you know, I don't want to spoil her little story arc, but the decision was one she had to make initially, and then she just stood up and went, nah, enough, no more, and, as you say, came out.
Yeah.
And I quite like that little story arc, to be honest.
Yeah, I did as well. And I loved Viva's brother, the part he played in it as well. It was very sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, actually, you're right. Tennis is one of those sports where coming out is is the way's already been paved, I suppose, especially for women. I think it's a different case for men, as it is in a lot of sports. We were talking about this actually with some friends of mine the other day. We were saying which sports are most accepted to come out, and I think in the UK in football, women's football, and I think probably all around the world as well, as you say, not in every country, but it's so accepted to come out as a woman in women's football, whereas for men it's the complete opposite way. So yeah, it's interesting how they vary.
Well that's it. I think you know, the male players, I can't actually think of one out gay male tennis player, not one.
No.
And yet there surely has to be, surely.
Yeah.
No,
can't
think of one.
Yeah. So your book as well, it's about tennis, but it's also about Australia. And as we said, you live in Queensland, and that features as the home of Viva, the tennis player, in the book. And I'd say it's almost another character, the setting in the book. It's very grounded in where it is. So what's the key to creating that? And is that important to you in all your books?
It is important. I'm the sort of writer who I've written about other settings, but I've always been living in them at the time. If I have a setting, if one of my characters is in a setting, I want to include not great screeds of description about the sun on the water or anything, but just little things that actually make the setting a part of who she is and a part of the plot line and a part of the storyline. And I've always done this, and I probably always will. But it's just little things. It's not dropping in massive, heavy-handed hints or anything. It's just maybe just a word that a character uses, or the dust on the road, or whatever, just to try and set that Australian setting.
Mm-hmm.
Always done it. I think I always will.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it, actually, because it's nice to read a book based somewhere that I haven't been. So, it was nice to see that. And also, as well as the Aussie landscape, you've got Aussie slang. You've got my wife's from Sydney and always uses the word darl. It's muttered a lot in our house. And just like Viva's mum does in the book. Do you get any sort of pushback from your publisher about that, or do readers seem to like it?
Firstly, my publisher, Ilva Publishing, they're fantastic about it. And they let us authors pick which version of English we want to use. They probably would rather I used American English, but they're quite accepting of Australian English, and we use Macquarie Dictionary and all the rest of it. But I do say to them, look, if there's anything when you're reading, when you're editing, if there's anything that you don't understand, just flag it, because I don't want to completely baffle readers. And I've had a couple of comments from readers that say, oh, I've had to use the, thesaurus or the Aussie dictionary or whatever to get a couple of things. So I have eased back a little bit, maybe, but I don't want to remove it completely, because language is part of a character, and we all talk differently, and we all have our own slang and our own way of our own expressions. And I don't want to remove them from my Aussie characters' mouths, because that would be a bit bland, I think. So I trust that readers can either work it out from the context, or maybe they're happy just to look it up occasionally. But I don't think there's too many lookups. At least I hope there isn't.
No, I don't think so. I know for me, I get a lot of comments from readers saying that they really like the British expressions that I use. So I'm sure it's the same with Australian as well. And it's like I say, it's nice reading something from a different part of the world, isn't it? Because so many books are set in America. So.
Yeah, and I have to say, I love your London books, and I love the very English way of talking you have in your books. And because I grew up there, it's just sort of refreshing. It's just like going back there for a little journey for 2 hours.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. That's lovely to hear. Thank you. Yeah, but I get that a lot. One of my nieces reads all my books, and she says she loves that as well. She's like, oh, it's like being in a room with you. I said, the characters are not me, remember?
I have to say that too.
Yeah. So you've written another series as well, as we said, also set in Australia, the Girl Meets Girl series. A lot of alliteration in those titles, so big up for that. And tell us a bit more about those and the story behind them.
Well, that was the first one, Never Tied Nora, was the first longer story I wrote. It's a novella. And actually that one is set in London. And I wrote it on the train to Brisbane. So it's actually the first book that I wrote when I wasn't actually in the setting.
Right.
But the characters... The whole series is about interconnecting friends. So each book stands alone. You don't have to read them in any particular order, although maybe you'll get slightly more if you did read them in order. But the first one's London, and the remaining three are set in Australia, in outback Queensland. And the last three, which are the Aussie ones, they focus around some friends there who work in rural settings. Sue from Not So Straight Sue is a lawyer in a very, very tiny outback town. Then Felix from Fenced In Felix, the third one, she runs a outback camping and trail riding place. And then the fourth one was, which is Almost Married Moni, is my little tribute to Australian marriage equality. And I wrote that purely to celebrate that when the vote was yes last year.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all outback stories. They are very Australian in their setting. If you thought that Code of Conduct had a bit of an Australian presence, then I think you'll get it even more so from those three books.
Okay, cool.
And there's a bit of humour, and there's a bit of a story, and there's a coming out story, and there's a bit of a mystery in one of them, and a lot of big-hearted romance and happy endings, and fairly low on the angst.
Right, okay. I like low angst, so I might have to give the London one a whirl.
Happen, and then you can move on to Australia.
Yeah. that's my first book that I ever wrote, London Calling. Had it the other way around. It started in Australia and then came to London, so there you go.
I read that one. That's Jess and Lucy, isn't it?
Yes. And I actually did the same. I started writing. The reason it was started in Australia was I was in Australia with my wife. It was 10 years ago I started writing it. And I started writing it in a cafe on Oxford Street in Sydney. And so I set it in Sydney because I was there. So it's amazing how literal we writers are sometimes, isn't it? But we came over last December for my nephew's wedding to Sydney, and we landed the day after the yes came through for the equal marriage. So that was very cool. And my brother and his wife were there, and they bought us a bottle of bubbles, and we toasted it on a rooftop in Sydney. So that was very nice.
Oh, that's good. It was a good moment. It was a very good moment, that yes vote. And yeah, it was honestly bloody, bloody late, Australia.
Come yeah, on, I know. I know. No one could believe that Australia still didn't have equal marriage. I was like, I know. Yeah, it's weird. So you've lived all over the globe and you're settled in Oz. How long were you in? You grew up in the UK. So how long were you here for?
I'm a bit of a mongrel. I grew up in the UK and I didn't come to Australia till I was 21.
Right.
And then I've been here, and then I've been in the States for 10 years and, excuse me, and Ireland for 6 or 7, and then shorter stints in Switzerland, Canada.
All right. Okay. So you've lived all over. So you could set your books in any one of these places. Do you think you'll be travelling to a different spot anytime soon?
Well, I'm going to New Zealand next month for a holiday, but that's just a holiday. No, I think I'll be in Australia for the foreseeable future. I'm sure I'll be back in the States at some point in the future. Yeah. A lot of my short erotica is set in Colorado and Ireland and other places, because a short erotica, you can... You know, it's less of a time investment, isn't it? So you can dash off a quick short story when you're on holiday.
Yeah. Yeah, got it. So, and as well as writing, you also do editing on the side. You were the editor for my recent foray into co-writing with Harper Bliss. I forgot her name then. Harper? Who? For Once Upon a Princess. And you did a really stellar job on that one. So do you enjoy the editing as well as the writing? And how do you fit it all in?
Well, firstly, thanks for the nice comments. I'm glad the edit was okay.
Yeah, it's great.
I do like editing. In fact, I like editing. I like that first pass through my own writing better than actually writing the first draft.
Right.
So I do like it, but it's not my main sort of aim. You know, I'm primarily a writer, and I do a bit of editing on the side.
Yeah.
So I do have to I work full time. And I can only work on one project at a time. So if I'm writing something and I have something to edit, I'll put my writing aside for that time when I'm editing and then go back to it. So I sort of have to juggle a bit. But it's entertaining. It's worthwhile. And I genuinely like doing it. And Once Upon a Princess was really great. I really enjoyed that one. I think you and Harper did a great job on that.
Oh, thank you. It's very nice of you to say so. And when you say you have a full-time job, is that the editing or do you have a different job?
No, I work in a law firm. I'm a paralegal, so it's, boring 9-to-5 type stuff.
Right, okay. Wow, so you fit in a lot. Well done, you.
Well, I have an office these days rather than a cubicle, so I get to close my door and write at lunchtimes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that helps. Yeah. I used to do that, actually, when I was working in an office. But I was a journalist, so I was writing anyway, so it's always a little bit tricky. But nice to have something that is not writing in the day job, I suppose, from that perspective.
Well, you do a lot of writing as a paralegal too.
But... Oh, yeah, I suppose, yeah.
We refer to the above.
So when you are writing, so you've got the full-time job, you've got a bit of editing, so how do you fit in your writing stints? Is it mainly, like, as you say, lunchtimes and weekends?
To be honest, I don't write at home much because I am total procrastinator. And if I try and write at home, I go, oh, laundry needs doing. Oh, I think I'll make a loaf of bread. Oh, look, fridge, cheese, wine. And I don't get much done. So most of my writing's done at work or early in the morning. And when I'm traveling, like, I write on planes, they're brilliant. A plane journey is just basically writing time.
Mm.
So planes, trains, automobiles.
Yeah.
As a passenger.
Yeah. All right. Okay, that's interesting. So weekends, you're just chilling out at home. You're not writing.
Oh, I will. If I'm editing something, I'll do a lot of that on weekends at home, and I will do some writing.
Yeah.
But I can't get the long, uninterrupted stints that I can at work.
Yeah. Okay.
I can write fast, and I can write more in an hour's lunchtime at work than I can in 3 hours at home.
Right. Yeah. It's the constant battle for the writer, isn't it? I've just actually read Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art, and that was have you read that? That was interesting.
No.
Yeah, it's a good read, actually. And it was about sort of resistance to writing and how to overcome it. Because it's a daily battle.
I think I should read that one.
Yeah. it's very good, actually. I've just read Stephen King's On Writing, and then I followed it up with that. So they're two very, I find a lot of books about writing, they're a bit dry, whereas these two are not. These two are both sort of very readable. So that was interesting.
Oh, okay. Maybe when you're doing one of your newsletters or something, you could drop in the title of that second one, because I think I need to hunt it down.
Okay, I'll put it in for you, just for you next time. I was actually going to put that in because I've got a newsletter coming up this week. So, yeah, I will be putting that in. So what's your favourite thing about writing then, and your least favourite, would you say?
Favourite thing is actually when the first draft is done, and then you've let it sit, and then you go back to it with fresh eyes, and you're doing the tweaking and the making notes and, oh, plot hole and all the little editing-y type things. But on your own work, it's you don't have to justify it. You can just basically polish it and tweak it and rewrite it and make it good, because the first draft is probably the thing I actually like the least. Mm-hmm. And I go through terrible, oh, it's awful, this is the worst thing I've ever written, oh my god, it's so bad, and oh, this is fabulous. And really, reality is generally closer to the first, but the first drafts are very, very up and down, but the editing is where it all comes together, and you can sort of see the story cohesion better. Well, I can anyway. I'm sure other people are completely different in their approach. So that would be my favourite and my least favourite.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think I'm with you on that one. I think I used to love first drafts more than I do now. I'm at the moment 40,000 words into the final London book, and think it's Last week I thought it was terrible. At the weekend I thought it was not too bad. So we'll see how it goes. it's a common experience, isn't it? And are you an avid reader of Lesfic as well? And
oh yes, yes, I love it. I can't obviously read as much as I'd like because I'm writing and editing and working and, you know, doing all sorts of other things as well.
Yeah.
But I do read. I'll read maybe one or two books a week, whether they're lesfic or not lesfic.
Yeah.
And there's, I mean, we're so lucky, aren't we? Because there's so many great writers writing right now and a lot of them are very productive. So if you get a favourite author, chances are they've written something else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always new authors to discover,
yeah,
and series and all sorts of things. And it's I think it's a really good time to be around lesfic, whether you're a reader or a writer.
No, I completely agree. I don't think there's ever been a better time, really. I mean, I remember, you know, going to bookshops in the 80s and 90s, and you know, the lesfic shelf was very small, and now the shelf is pretty infinite, so that's amazing. And do you have like have you been given a best piece of writing advice that's helped you along the way?
It's just like bum seat, just bloody do it,
yeah,
and turn the bloody internet off. that's all there is to it, you know. Just that's why I think I'm so productive at work, because I don't have the distractions.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not tempted to look at my work email, so I don't. It's just me and the computer screen, whereas it's the rest of it, it's all distraction, isn't it? You know, whether it's checking Facebook or the email or, yeah, or the fridge, you know, yeah, it's all just those little things that add up and take you away from writing.
Yeah, all true. And I think actually Jay was the one who edited your code of conduct, right? I interviewed her for this podcast way back. I think she was like one of the first 10 people I interviewed, and she told me that just turn the internet off, and that was like a blinding piece of good advice for me then. I don't think I'd considered it. But
she's full of good advice, trust me.
Yeah. So I do try to do that. I don't always succeed, but yeah, well done, Jay. She changed my process. And I also know that you're a big foodie, because I see you post a lot of stuff on Instagram and it always looks delicious what you're eating, I have to say. So do you have a favourite dish you're cooking at the moment? And when you're up against a deadline, what is the thing you go to the fridge for?
Oh, well, you're dead right. I do like to cook. I'd like to cook and I like to eat. But as far as favourite things to cook, well, I'm sort of big into, because I live rural, so I'm lucky. And I realise not everybody can do this, but we have a big veggie patch and we grow a lot of our own food and we have fruit trees and stuff like that. So I like to use what's local around me.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way, you know, I rightly or wrongly think maybe the food is healthier or whatever. So I cook a lot of stuff that's in season and available locally. As for favourite food, this is very, very boring, but I love it so very much. I love macaroni cheese made properly with real pasta and cheese and cream and bits of bacon in it. No packets of dried pasta with yellow chemicals.
No. Yeah, I think that's what put me off macaroni cheese as a child, the tins of it. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember those tins, and there's absolutely no texture to it. It's just sog.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a huge cheese fan, but my wife would be there, right there with you. She's a cheese fiend. So, yeah. So what's next for you then? What are you working on at the moment?
Well, I was on holiday last week, but the only work thing I did was actually send the manuscript to my next novel off to Ilva Publishing.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting to hear if they like it, of course, but I hope they will. And that is the working title is The Lawyer and the Farm Girl, which is only a working title, but it pretty much tells you what it's about.
Yeah.
And again, I'm writing what I know, because lawyer in there, you know, yeah, lawyer working in a law firm. So that's just gone off, and that will obviously be a while in development and in processing and editing and all the rest of it. So I'm starting to think about the one after that now, and I'm pretty sure that's going to be set on a yacht, about somebody who accidentally stows away to New Zealand.
That's interesting. Interesting.
That's still in my head at the moment. I haven't actually started writing it. I'm having a few days off right now.
So are you going to have to go and have a holiday on a yacht? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, I don't know about the yacht. I'm not a very good sailor. But I am actually quite coincidentally going to New Zealand next month for a holiday. But that's a camper van holiday, not a yachting holiday.
Yeah.
But I'll be looking at New Zealand settings while I'm there, I think.
Yeah, cool. I do love New Zealand. Have you been before?
Yes, this is the second time. This time we're going to the South Island more. Last time we were in the North Island. But it's going to be, it's September, August, September. So it's going to be freezing cold.
Yeah, it does get really cold there. The first time I went, I think it was in July and it was bitter. And I didn't have a coat because, you know, I was young and stupid. So, yeah, had to drink a lot of wine.
Yeah, and they have really good wine.
They do. Yeah, no, it's beautiful and very unspoilt there. So I keep having to say to my wife, we have to go, because obviously being Australian, she hasn't been because it's too close. So, yeah. So final question. If you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Any two writers. Well, one would have to be Oscar Wilde, because his humour, it just shines. And how, I mean, when was he alive? It was, 18, 19 something? And his wit is just immortal. It just lives on forever, whether it was 100 years ago or whether it's now. He's just so funny and so witty, and he's a master of the one-line zingers. So I think he would have to be one half. The other half, a very current modern writer. Her name's Lainey Taylor, and it's probably somebody not many people have heard. She actually writes young adult fantasy books.
Okay.
But she's got this most beautiful lyrical turn of phrase, and her sentences just make me gasp because they're so beautifully put together. And then she strings them together and there's suddenly a whole paragraph of them, and then there's a whole chapter of them. And as part of anything else, she can tell a story. So I'm reading one of hers right now, and it's consuming me.
Oh, wow. So, okay. Sounds very good. So maybe I'll have to check that out. Lainey Taylor.
She's not a lesbian author, just a young adult fantasy author, but she's fabulous. Check out Daughter of Smoke and Bone.
Okay. All right. I will. Well, thank you so much, Cheyenne. This has been terrific. I hope you have a lovely evening and another glass of wine, because you've chatted a lot, so you need some lubrication.
Thank you. Thank you, Claire. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to finish my glass of wine and cook dinner, which I think is going to be Spanish garlic chicken.
Oh, sounds nice. Well, enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You enjoy the rest of your day and don't drink too much tea.
I won't. That's the end of this lesbian book club, so this is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you fancy giving any of my books a go, the London Romance series, the All I Want series, Nothing to Lose, or Twice in a Lifetime, you can find out more at www.clairelydon.co.uk, or just look me up on Amazon, Kobo, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, Bella, or any of the other digital outlets. I'm also on Twitter at Claire Lydon, Facebook Claire.Lydon, and Instagram at ClaireFic. Plus, if you'd like a free lesbian romance, sign up to my VIP Readers Club and I'll send you one for free. Just go to www.clairelydon.co.uk and fill in the box at the top of the page. Join me next time for more hot book club action, where I'll be interviewing sci-fi and steampunk author Lise McTeague. See you then.